I'm Christopher Lloyd, and this is The Connection. More than 4,700 black men and women were tortured, mutilated, roasted, dismembered, and hung in public squares all over the American South between 1882 and 1968. Lynchings were public rituals. Mobs of white people gathered at the scenes and took photographs and sometimes scrambled for their own souvenir charred body part. Our guest, James Allen, is an antiques collector who has gathered an extraordinary series of photographs for an exhibit in New York and for a new book called Without Sanctuary. The photographs come from postcards that were produced and sent through the mail. They show the lifeless forms of bodies hanging from trees, from bridges and telegraph poles, and they show crowds of shameless white onlookers. Some of the postcards bear personal inscriptions like, for example, "This is the barbecue we had last night. My picture is to the left with a cross over it. Your son, Joe." The story of lynching in America is the story of unspeakable violence and torture by white people, and it became almost routine. One Southern bishop noted, "Nowadays, it seems the killing of Negroes is not so extraordinary an occurrence as to need explanation. It's become so common that it no longer surprises. We read of such things as we read of fires that burn a cabin or a town." We're talking about lynching on The Connection this hour with James Allen and the historian Leon Litwack, author of Trouble in Mind and the book Been in the Storm So Long. Leon Litwack has written an introduction to this book, Without Sanctuary. You can see some of James Allen's lynching photographs on our Connection website at TheConnection, one word, .org. Connection listeners, what sense do you make of this deeply dark chapter of American history? 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK makes the lynching connection. James Allen, welcome. You've shown us in this book vastly more than I knew or wanted to know about lynching. I wish you'd pick any one of these scores of extraordinary pictures and kind of read it for us. Help us read it.
I'd be glad to. The image that I'll describe first is actually covers the end papers of the book. It is from a sepia-toned real photo postcard. It's been blown up to two-page size, so the detail is very good in the image. I pick it out because it's one of the few images that survive that actually depict the torture of an African-American by a mob. The term lynching can be quite deceiving. Lynching can be hanging, shooting, drowning, beating, and in many cases, particularly as the lynching phenomena advanced in the 20th century, the rituals became more tortuous and extended for a longer period of time so that the crowd could be entertained by the pain of the victim. In this case, it's a 17-year-old boy by the name of Jess Washington, who was mentally retarded and was accused of having killed a farm owner, a woman by the name, I think her name was Mrs. Robinson, but I'm not absolutely certain. Anyway, this picture depicts the courthouse oak tree. The photograph was taken from the mayor's office window of Waco, Texas. So you're looking down onto a sea of hats and skimmers, all types of hats.
One that looks like every kind of hat, straw boaters and felt hats and skimmers, as you say, working class, banker-type hats.
Golf duffers or whatever they call these golf-type hats. It's corner-to-corner hats. And in the center is this oak tree with a long chain and around its thickest limb, and a man has lowered Jess Washington onto the flames of a pyre of salvaged lumber and scraps of wood. And he has a mitten on because the chain is hot. And another man has a stick in which he keeps Jess Washington on top of the flame. His body is limp. There are gashes of flesh torn out of him as if eaten by a shark. When Jess Washington attempted to climb up the links of the chain to get out of the fire, they cut off his fingers. They had already cut off his ears and castrated him. They would raise him above the fire for the 15,000 spectators' enjoyment to show them, and as the newspaper said, a mighty shout rose into the air, and then lower him back down into the flames. People are raised on the shoulders of other people so they can see above the crowd and get a very good look.
You say 15,000 people?
15,000 people. The people came from counties all around. In many cases, they overtook trains, hijacked trains so that they could get to the spectacle. Newspapers let people know the night before that a lynching was planned in some cases. It was a major event that most people didn't want to miss.
I want to ask you, what was the coverage of this kind of thing in the newspapers, in the public prints? Were names taken? Were people... this was somewhere in the near underground of a community's experience. Some of them announced them, as you say, but this was not like a town meeting.
Well, this was community-sanctioned violence. Community-sanctioned murder, and the community would protect the mob leaders so that they would not be incriminated or have to suffer any legal punishment. But the newspapers covered these in tremendous detail. It was a sensational event, and in the case of the Leo Frank lynching in Atlanta, Georgia, they would sell five times the newspapers that they would on a regular basis when there was sensational stories like this to cover. So they were covered in great detail.
And in what spirit? Like a World Series game, or was it considered, as you say, they were protecting the ringleaders who were doing some kind of sanctioned lawbreaking here. How did they handle that? What did people think they were doing, in other words?
People had rationales for this type of violence, which are difficult for us to understand today and were difficult for some people to understand then. But most importantly, the newspapers covered these events. And if they gave a critical view to it, they always did that with a caveat that public justice and public outrage was served, or the victims' crimes were so terrible that people just couldn't help themselves. And they gave a nod to it if they didn't outright approve of it and print editorials to that fact that some governors had said, if I was there, I would have led the mob.
The other thing that's so striking in this picture of Jess Washington and in the story you tell is that these were... mob attacks on powerless people. Powerful people were never lynched. And this was a man who was underage, who was mentally defective to begin with. And it seemed all to whip up the righteous violence being inflicted on him.
Obviously, these white men were threatened by something. And so the sexual tensions and the loose boundaries between whites and blacks. But the black male was a tremendous threat to white men, and that's the only account that you can give for the immediate violence that so many black men met when white people perceived that they crossed a social boundary.
But why this special targeting of powerless people? Of a mentally retarded person here, say this is not a figure of strength. This is a figure of pathetic helplessness.
Again, I don't think that white men actually saw these people as helpless. I think they had a tremendous fear for the power that was, the potential that was in African Americans. And I don't know, if Leon, if you have...
Leon Littbeck, welcome to the conversation. Leon Littbeck joins us from California. He's a professor of history at the University of California in Berkeley. Help us read these pictures, Leon Littbeck.
Well, I think Jimmy Yellen has already given a very good description of what happened and of the target of this particular lynching and the fear that whites had of blacks in this period can be explained in a number of different ways. For many whites, what they were confronting in the late 19th and early 20th century, and this is when we had the great majority of lynchings, was essentially a new generation of black men and women coming of age. That is the first generations born in freedom, unschooled in their eyes in the necessary racial etiquette, and who were deemed a threat for some whites, a threat economically, for many whites, a threat socially. One difficult fact to accept in this period, among others, is that the target of white violence was quite often blacks who, in fact, were succeeding. Blacks who were prospering, blacks who, by the very nature of their success, challenged the long-held beliefs about white superiority and black inferiority. So I think all these things played a role in the kinds of victims who were selected and the kind of justice that was meted out. And history is often made up of what people think happened rather than what happened. So despite what the lynchers and even their own communities often said, most white Southerners did believe that rape and attempted rape were primary reasons for lynching, even though they constituted alleged rape or even rape itself constituted only a very small percentage of the cases of those who were brought to so-called lynching justice.
What is the illusion that's being punctured by these remarkable pictures for you, Leon Littbeck?
Well, I find particularly when I confronted the documentation on lynching for the book Trouble in Mind, and incidentally, for a chapter on lynching, a rather extensive chapter on lynching called Hellhounds, I believe I used only about a fourth of the materials I had collected. There was so much material. Jimmy Allen's already talked about the newspaper accounts that were very full. They just reported in a very matter-of-fact sort of way. I was prepared certainly for the violence. I knew about lynchings beforehand. I wasn't prepared, I think, as much for the sadism that permeated these lynchings, and I think it's clear when you look at the photographs. What sometimes captures you is not even so much the man or woman, incidentally, not just men were lynched, the man or woman who was lynched, but the crowds, the faces. I can never get out of my mind the smiling face of the must be about a 12 or 13 year old girl who's standing perhaps next to her father looking at a lynched black. And the other point that became very clear is that if according to legend, rednecks played a major role in the lynching tragedy, we find in fact that they did so with the tacit consent and sometimes the very active participation of those who are regarded as their social betters.
What about the churches?
The churches. That's a rather sad tale in itself. Since many of the lynchers were themselves members of churches, I would say that the vast majority of lynchers thought of themselves as good, decent, God-fearing Christians. And because of that reason, the church leaders hesitated to criticize the lynchings. In fact, one pastor who I've quoted in my introductory essay simply said that I can't criticize these people because they're a part of my parish and I'll lose them if I'm critical of what's happening. But in many instances, in fact, churchmen were able to justify the lynchings, justified in the higher idealism that these people felt about the superiority of their race and then what they were doing was in the best interest of their race.
Looking at these pictures, I wonder what tipped these mobs to this kind of vigilante summary executions and all the sort of social sadism around them, as opposed to putting people to trial, getting evidence, witnesses, and sort of a deliberate process.
Let me go back to this photo for just a minute, Leon.
Sure.
Jess Washington was dragged from the courtroom when he was pronounced guilty by this mob. These photos really don't have anything to do with vigilantism. They have a lot more to do with racial dominance and some of sadistic behavior. I still can't explain, but all of these victims in this book were accused of a crime, and I believe in the majority of cases it was a fabricated excuse for practicing this type of violence.
I think what you also find, the phenomenon that you confront in the late 19th, again in early 20th century, is that for many whites, given what they thought to be the nature of the threat, the ordinary modes of trial and execution and punishment were just no longer deemed sufficient. They didn't satisfy the emotional appetite of the crowd. Even to kill a victim was not enough. So the execution needed to be turned into a public ritual, a kind of collective experience, and the victim needed to be subjected to what amounted to extraordinary torture and mutilation. So what had in the past been a usually rapid dispatch of a victim, that was the old way of lynching, now by the late 19th and early 20th century becomes part of a voyeuristic spectacle, prolonged as long as possible for the benefit of the crowd.
The historian Leon Litvak is our guest, along with James Allen, the collector of the scores and scores of public photographs of lynchings from the American South from the 1880s well into the middle of the 20th century in this country. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with an unspeakably detailed and dark slice of American history, and his book, James Allen's book, Without Sanctuary. 1-800-423-8255. Rob is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Rob.
Let me just start off by saying that I share your absolute horror at seeing these images, and I also say that I've never been a person who subscribed to the notion of collective guilt for white people. My ancestors came to this country after slavery, you know, was abolished and all that. But in looking at these pictures, and especially, as your guest says, the faces in the crowd, you get such a sense that you're looking, you know, right into the face of the utter evil, or if you personify it as the devil, you know, the devil. And it also brought home to me, which is why I think this is a good exhibit. I mean, you sort of understand, well, not understand, but you can't imagine how any black person could look at these photos and feel anything but utter soul-wrenching anger. Now, that said, weren't there any white people around who looked at this and said, this is really wrong? I mean, how can you people be doing this?
James Allen.
Okay. Yes, there were, and but they seemed to be as equally powerless many times as the African American community. There were cases, a number of cases of sheriffs, law enforcement people who lost their lives or made a valiant effort to protect a victim. In most cases, though, the lawmen saw this as, why would I risk my life for a nigger whose life is worth less than my own, and why would I go up against the people who voted me into office?
Well, is this a pervasive thing? So, like, if this happened, you're sort of talking about this 13-year-old girl, you know, with her father.
Mm-hmm.
Did everybody, like, around the whole county feel that way? I mean, that's just...
Go ahead, you know, Leon.
Leon, look back.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just thought I'd just begin for a moment. No, there are some opponents. There are editorials denouncing lynching even in this period. There are a few public officials who plead with mobs to permit the law to execute the individual. And I say that not facetiously. There is something we call a legal lynching. That is, in order to appease a crowd, there will be a very fast and speedy trial. Perhaps the best example, however, of Southern opposition, white Southern opposition, would be the campaign organized by a woman, a white woman, Jessie Daniel Ames, who organizes against lynching and forms an organization, the Association of Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching. But as Mr. Allen has indicated, quite correctly, this was a very small and powerless group.
Was there any organized opposition to this in the North, in places where they didn't have lynching, or... I don't. Maybe they did have lynching in the North. I'm not sure, but was there any North-South dividing line like there was in the Civil War regarding this issue? Did people in Chicago, you know, hear about this and say this is wrong? Somebody should stop this.
Again, there were editorials denouncing lynching, but the majority of opposition, of course, came from blacks. North and South, and let it be said that the lynching could not have succeeded to the extent that it did without the collusion of local and state authorities in the South, the indifference of most Americans, North and South, and let me add the moral cowardice, I would call it, of Presidents Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson, who after all presided over this nation at that particular time, and who could not get themselves to utter any real denunciation of what was happening in their own country.
1-800-423-8255 makes the lynching connection. Could I ask you, Leon Whitbeck, what was the closest thing to a foothold in the North for this kind of justice?
Well, there are some examples, in fact, in the book, Without Sanctuary. There are examples of lynchings that occur outside of the South. So there are some lynchings in the West. There are lynchings in the Midwest. There are lynchings in other parts of the country directed at other minority groups, Italians, Mexicans, Asians. But the vast majority of the lynchings by the late 19th century are taking place in the in the South. But it should be noted that until the 1890s, lynching had been neither a racial phenomenon nor a regional phenomenon, that lynching had been largely a way of preserving law and order in the West, and most of the victims of lynchings were whites up until the 1880s and 1890s.
We'll come back. I mean, I want to come back to other kinds of lynchings, or the general social circumstances that that promote kind of community-sanctioned violence, summary justice, social sadism. We'll come back to that after the break. 1-800-423-8255 makes the lynching connection. Deanna is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Deanna.
Hi. I'm actually an old
student of Leon Litwax from Berkeley, and I'm so glad that you're doing this on the show. I saw the exhibit in New York last Friday and thought it was really wonderful. I've never seen so many black people in a museum before. but I had a question. I wanted to bring up the issue of gender. Hello?
Yes.
The readings I've been doing lately in this subject talk about lynching also in terms of policing white womanhood, in terms of the whole issue of the rape reason for why people were lynched. I guess a third of the lynching were professed to be about, you know, concerns that black men had insulted or raped or whatever white women, and how that was also about warning women who would transgress the color line against, you know, the serious consequences of that. And I wanted to ask about the other possibilities that people don't talk about as much, which is about sort of interracial relationships during this period, which were generally illegal. And how often, I wanted to ask those people, because there's quite a few lynching of white men, quite a few lynchings of white men, with the Leo Frank thing, the Italians in New Orleans, and there were a few other photographs of Italians at the exhibit, which is a separate issue, I guess.
Yeah, it takes a great student to ask that many questions. We're going to have to pause over the break to think of the answers, but specifically this matter of rape as a reason and the sort of sexual subtext of this whole dark story. Leon Litwack and James Allen are, I guess, we're talking about their book, Without Sanctuary. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
That's Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit we're talking about. James Allen's remarkable collection of photographs of lynchings in the American South from the 1880s well into this century. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. Lynchings as a social institution, as a political caution. Lynchings as the subject of postcards that people mailed proudly, in which people, huge crowds of white onlookers, showed themselves shamelessly. 1-800-423-8255 makes the lynching connection. The historian Leon Litwack joins us from Berkeley, California. Your student, Deanna, raised the question about the whole undercurrent of sexual and gender relations here. Is there a way to sum it up?
Well, I would, again, I would repeat what I had said earlier, that despite the fact that alleged rape accounted for only about a quarter of the lynchings in this period.
What were the rest?
We can get into that a little later, because that's a long list of alleged crimes that, when committed by so-called crimes that, when committed by white people, were not crimes at all. That is, from impudence to whites to labor organizing. Testifying in court against whites, insubordination, talking disrespectfully,
driving a better buggy,
improper demeanor, etc. But going back to the point that Deanna raised, and I think it's a point also made quite persuasively by Orlando Patterson in his recent book on Rituals of Blood, and that is that the Southern male conception of the sexual threat was broad enough to embrace most crimes. And he quotes a Methodist minister who went so far as to say that danger to women is inherent in every offense against white men. That perhaps sums up, in part at least, the complicated issue that we confront here. Of course, whites seemed absolutely incapable of grasping the fundamental hypocrisy that condemned black rape of white women and condoned or ignored white rape of black women. But for a black man, there's no question about it. Any sexual advance or anything perceived as a sexual advance to a white woman was a certain invitation to a tortured death. But for a white man, the exploitation of a black woman for his sexual initiation very often, or pleasure, enjoyed community toleration. And of course, the most expedient way to dispose of the whole issue was to deny the very existence of a white rapist. There cannot be a white rapist because white women were said to give themselves willingly and even wantonly to white men.
Black women.
Black women, excuse me.
Yeah, black women.
Black women.
You know, if I could just go back to this one issue about lynchings in the North, because they took place really into the 30s. You've got 1920, Duluth, Minnesota, the lynching of three black circus workers who were quickly proven to, is actually quickly proven after the incident that there was no assault and it was completely fabricated by a young couple in Duluth, Minnesota. And one of the really more horrific images in the book is from Cairo, Illinois, 1907, the lynching of Will James, where we have a portrait of Will James on a penny postcard before he was accused of the murder of a young girl. And then the final image in a series of 15 cards, we have the half-burnt head of James is written on the card, stuck on a pole in the city park for people to relish. So,
yeah, let me. I just wanted to add one thing, and that is, this is not an attempt to deny that some of the black men who faced lynch mobs had not been responsible for violence against white men. What we have to keep in mind is that in many cases African Americans were defending either themselves or the honor of their wives and members of their families, or in many cases they were responding to the outrages to which they were subjected.
Go ahead. Do you want to finish that thought?
And it's important to keep in mind too Frederick Douglass, among others. It might be said something of the desperation of blacks that blacks felt in the 1890s, but that some black leaders actually thought lynching was a sign of black progress. That is, that blacks were being lynched because they were progressing, because they were making something of themselves, because they were asserting their independence, because they're trying to be something in a society that deemed them nothing.
1-800-423-8255 makes the lynching connection with Leon Littwack, professor of history at Berkeley, and with James Allen, who has just collected this record in a book called Without Sanctuary, an exhibition at the New York Historical Society. Would you want to comment a little bit on Deanna's point about the popular response to this exhibition and the feeling, the complexity of feeling white and black and universal that it prompts. What do you read in the faces of the crowds looking at these pictures, James Allen?
I think that all the visitors to the exhibition, which is now at the New York Historical Society and will be there till July the 9th, and for those who tried to get in earlier, it's in a very large gallery now, and there's no waiting, and people waited out in the cold and the ice through the month of February, sometimes for 3 hours at a time to get in, and we still had to turn away a couple hundred people a day. There's a great mix of emotions. And interesting enough, after the Amadou Diallo situation, a tremendous amount of anger is being directed forward because of this exhibit, where people before were trying to understand it. Now people are extremely angry when they come to see the exhibit. And I even had a woman yesterday say that it made her want to go out and kill someone. So what it is doing is showing the depth of the pain in the African-American community, and for making it clear for people like myself who have not had to experience that, that it's a very real thing. Don't discount it. And that the extreme measures that were taken and seen in these photos to subjugate blacks, they reflect the fact that white people, the majority, were incredibly creative and in subjugating blacks in every aspect of their lives. And this is just the most extreme example. But it's easy to see that when you see these. And go ahead.
1-800-423-8255, The Lynching Connection. Wes is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Wes.
I had a comment about the way that basically the Ku Klux Klan and that the way that they were able to really kind of become part of the dominant political scene in America during that time between post Reconstruction and the Depression. For instance, they inducted President Warren G. Harding as a member in a White House ceremony. And
is this true?
Yes.
KKK inducted Harding in the White House.
In the White House.
Any contest on that, James Allen or Leon Littleback?
I don't know. It's been alleged that he belonged to the Klan. Let me just add that among all the presidents of this period, Warren G. Harding is the only president I know of who actually devoted an entire speech to race relations and gave it in the South. And it was one of the more remarkable indictments of racism delivered by any president from the period 1900 to the 1930s.
What was the rule? The caller, Wes, is sort of putting the KKK in the kind of dominant alliance of the period.
Well, that's a little complicated in the sense that the Ku Klux Klan is essentially out of business after Reconstruction and doesn't come back into doesn't begin to play an active role again until the 1920s, the 19-teens. Particularly with the filming of The Birth of a Nation, which of course celebrated the Ku Klux Klan as a savior of the old South. The Klan comes back into existence in the 1920s. By that time, it is largely a national phenomenon. That is, it's strong in Midwestern states, it's strong in many Western states, as it is strong in the South. Also, its targets have been expanded somewhat to include Catholics and Jews as well as blacks. But the Klan is indeed responsible for a number of outrages on blacks in the South and elsewhere in the 1920s.
I don't think there's any accurate count of how many murders have taken place in the name of white supremacy that could accurately portray the Klan's involvement in this type of violence.
Wes, has your point been made?
I think so. I think, well, that, you know, I just, you know, that's something the You know, and he mentioned before, like in that period, in the between 1900 and 1930, you know, there was really, you know, it was an accepted okay thing, you know, to you know, because white supremacy was the you know, that was what everybody was taught to believe, you know, and so I think that is. And it was coming all the way from the very top of the United States government.
Wes, thank you.
I'd like to point out another image in the book that portrays very clearly the lynching of Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith in Marion, Indiana, in August of 1930, a famous lynching. The one photo that is known that was published in the tens of thousands and sold for 50 cents a piece at the time as a souvenir of the lynching portrays Abram Smith. He actually has a Klan robe wrapped around his lower body like a loincloth, and that was donated by a Klan member after the souvenir hunters had picked apart his pants piece by piece so that he would be covered up for the photograph.
1-800-423-8255. Carol is on the line.
Yes.
Hello, Carol.
I grew up in the South. Well, I grew up partly in the South. I went to high school and junior high school in the panhandle of Florida, which is very Southern. I'm white, you can tell from my speech. In the late 50s and early 60s, now we were taught, to the extent that we were taught anything at all about lynching, it was said that it was mostly because of the Yankees, that they would come down, and I'm not saying that I believe any of this, but that the Yankees would come down and or black people who went up north would come back with these strange ideas that they got from the Yankees, and they were dangerous, and that it was the fault mostly of the white folks of the north and mostly of the northeast, because, to quote the people around me, our Negroes would never do anything like that.
Would never show disrespect, or
exactly,
would never prompt a lynching?
Exactly. Now, I'm curious. I didn't believe any of that when I was there either, and I became active in the movement, and I tried to educate myself about all this. But I didn't really know what went on until I read Trouble in Mind, Mr. Litzhak's book. I was wondering, I haven't been to the South in many years. I don't go back. The extent to which white folks, white children now are being taught about any of this. I mean, we need to know. We need to know so we won't do it again.
What is being taught?
Well, I taught as a visitor at in 1990 at the University of Mississippi, and I taught the course on the history of African Americans and race relations since the Civil War. And when we came to this period, to the period of Jim Crow, the period of lynching, I described what happened and described some of the lynchings that are in Without Sanctuary. Several students came to me afterwards, and this class was made up entirely of Mississippians, with one exception, one Tennessean, and 90% of the class, or 95% of the class, was white, about 100 students. The students expressed absolute shock at what I had told them. They had never heard of any of this. They, in fact, said, after hearing about the lynchings, they said that they thought those were they believed it, and they thought that was incredible violence. But one of the students said, "But weren't you just kidding us, professor, about the separate drinking fountains?" And I said, "Where are you from?" And they said, "We're from Brookhaven, Mississippi." And I knew about Brookhaven, Mississippi, and it was a typical Mississippi small town. And they quickly said, "Well, we knew about segregated schools. Even the schools had once been segregated. We didn't know about the other stuff." And so, all right, they had been educated. But anyway, 2 weeks later, they came back to me and said, "Professor Litwack, we were home over the weekend, and we were telling our parents about what we were learning in this course." And I immediately anticipated the response of, "Well, what can you expect from a carpetbagger from Berkeley teaching you?" But no, that's not what they said at all. They said to their kids, "Well, yes, everything you've been told is true, and it's about time you learned about it." Mm-hmm. I was very struck by that comment, because what it suggested in terms of the absence of any education at home, as well as in school, about the subject, and we're now talking about 1990. Now, I find for my own students here at Berkeley that they, too, come into the course knowing little of anything about what happened in this period.
And in my travels as a picker going around buying things from all over the South, I put tens of thousands of miles on my truck a year. The word nigger is as common as dirt outside of the big cities. In many places, in the panhandle of Florida still, in South Georgia, in Mississippi, in North Georgia, you can, particularly though, in the deepest parts of the South, you can find areas that are as if they are living in the 19-teens or 20s. You know, by the end of the day, you just can't believe what you've heard in a single day and how accepted it is.
1-800-423-8255. Is the connection phone. Sheila is on the line.
Hi. Thanks, Chris, for taking my call, and thank you for doing this show. I think it's a topic that needs to be addressed, and especially in light of the current institution of the death penalty.
Yeah, I'm glad you said it. Go ahead.
It's not nearly as horrific as what happened 100 years ago, but it still has the same undertones of racism and questions of classism and guilt versus innocence. And I think that, as the previous caller stated, this is something that we need to talk about our history to learn about what's wrong with the present. And I was wondering if you could address this.
Well, I think you raised an important question. Bill Clinton, you know, presided over an execution of a mentally disabled black man as he went over the hill and, you know, went over the hump in Super Tuesday 8 years ago. George W. Bush has presided over the execution of scores and scores, well over 100 executions in Texas. And, you know, let each person speak for themselves, but the underlying feeling of righteousness and racism connects all of it, I think. That's my own two bits. James Allen?
I think the closest parallel to a lynch mob I ever saw was on TV the other night watching a documentary about a serial killer and his death penalty and his execution, and the crowd outside that was pro this murder. Murdering him, executing him, they were as jubilant and excited about the possibility and calling for this man's death in blood, and the clothes that they wore and the carnival atmosphere that was outside the prison by the mob. I just couldn't believe it. It's the first time I've ever witnessed that or seen that, and it really struck me as a close parallel to some of these images.
1-800-423-8255. Dan is on the line. Hello, Dan.
Yes, hi.
Welcome.
Hello?
Welcome.
Yeah, Stanley.
Stanley, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm calling from Roxbury.
Thank you, Stanley.
Yeah, an interesting program. I want to thank you for taking my call. And such programs like this is really good for the general public in terms of information.
Wait till you see the book, Stanley. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I archive stuff like this. For the last 40 years, I've been archiving similar things, news articles and whatever. But I wanted to say that I found it sort of difficult to understand the author's previous statement that it was a type of violence that we would find hard to comprehend today. I mean, the attitude is still there. I mean, the biggest lynch mob I've ever experienced was in Haymarket Square in the North End.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
what happened? When?
Well, that was back in the mid-60s. And since then, I've withstood over 25 attacks here in the city of Boston, including being shot at, insulted, and different things like that. But, you know, the information that he's giving is really good. But I have a question about...
Stanley, we're out of time, I'm sorry to say. You will be horrified and edified in many ways by the book, as we all are. It's called Without Sanctuary, Photographs of Lynchings Gathered by James Allen, with an introduction from the historian Leon Litwack. Thank you, Leon Litwack. Thank you, James Allen.
Thank you.
You can see some of these photographs on our website, www.theconnectiononeword.org. Thanks for help today from George Hicks, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fleet Boston Financial, sponsoring Boston's Gay Men's Chorus, singing the world premiere of Eos, March 25th and 26th at Jordan Hall, 617-424-89.